Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Thursday, November 17th, the California Coastal Commission approved a controversial proposal to build a new desalination plant in Monterey Bay. The commission's 8-2 vote came after 13 hours of debate at a Salinas public hearing that was packed with several hundred people. Most of the 375 constituents who signed up to speak opposed the project, some reportedly in tears. And the project's approval now comes 9 years after it was first proposed. Much of the opposition centered around environmental justice concerns. Constituents fear that putting this facility in the low-income city of Marina will increase their costs while sending the water to wealthier areas of the peninsula like Pebble Beach. So on today's Your Call, we're going to discuss the future of desalination in California in an era of climate-induced mega droughts. So how can the West access water while respecting environmental justice considerations? And what does this new Monterey Bay plant mean for the future of desalination in the state? Joining us to discuss are two guests. And for the first half hour of the program, we're going to be joined by Melody Krislock, who is a managing director of Public Water Now. She has lived on the Monterey Peninsula since 1971 and joined Public Water Now back in 2013. So Melody, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks so much for having me.
And for the full hour of the program, we're going to be joined by Dr. Nusha Ajami, who is the Chief Development Officer for Research at the Earth and Environmental Sciences Area at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Nusha was previously a gubernatorial appointee to the Bay Area Regional Water Quality Board for two terms and a current mayoral appointee to the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Nusha.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So, Nusha, let me start with you. There are currently four desalination plants that provide drinking water to California. And in May, another controversial plant was rejected in Huntington Beach, partially due to environmental concerns. But a smaller and less expensive plant was approved by Dana Point in October. So I'm wondering if you could just walk us through a bit of this history behind desalination in California. Where did this start and where are we now?
Sure. So there have been a number of desalination plants, as you mentioned, running in California. A majority of them are in smaller size. The one large one that we have is the Carlsbad desalination plant in San Diego. It's about 50 million gallon per day capacity desalination plant. And the one that they were trying to build in Huntington Beach was around the same size, a large desalination plant. The difference between these new ones that are being approved, they are considering different kind of intake, which is sort of subsurface intake, trying to minimize their environmental impact of the desalination process, which takes water, a lot of water out of the ocean, process it, and then puts back whatever is left over, which is called a brine or effluent, back to the ocean. And so there have been some new regulation, not new, actually, in during the past 6-7 years, State Board has set new regulations around best management practices around desalination plants, which includes trying to build new, the different kind of intakes, which takes water out of the subsurface to minimize marine impact, and then trying to minimize the impact of putting brine back to the environment. So the two desalination plants that have been approved, the one in Monterey and the one in Dana Point, both of them have been trying to incorporate those new models into their design. And they're also significantly smaller. The one in Dana Point was about 5 million gallon per person per day capacity, and the one that was just approved in Monterey was around the same size. So much smaller, more nimble, and potentially less environmental impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nusha, I appreciate you walking through some of the innovation and new regulations around desalination, but I'm wondering if you could also just describe a bit just how the process works. What is the technology involved to turn salt water into drinking water?
Sure. Basically, the salt water is taken out of the ocean, or actually any water can be put through this process and pushed through a number of membranes that takes all the sort of impurities out of water and pushes out clean drinkable water. The process is often takes everything out of water, so utilities or the generators need to put back into that water some additional minerals to make for taste, and so it's a quite a sophisticated process of purifying water. And it can be used actually to treat wastewater as well as other kind of water, like water with lower salinity as well. But it is in many parts of the world have been used to treat ocean water as part of desalination. So it's, you know, the water that comes out, it's drinkable and it's very, it's quite pure. So.
And Nusha, is there a different energy profile for these different
yes.
methods?
Yes. So the more salty water, the more energy we have to use. The water actually, one thing that I forgot to mention, the water is actually pushed through these membranes. So it requires a lot of energy to be able to create this pure water on the other side. So the amount of energy that's used in the process is quite intense. And that's one sort of shortcoming of the desalination process. If we use, for example, if you use wastewater or water with lower salinity, the amount of energy that's required to push water through the membranes is less. So it's much more preferable and uses a lot less energy. But the saltier the water, the more energy it's required to push water through. And also the amount of the quality of the brine that's left behind and the treatment that's required differs depending on what kind of water is pushed through the desalination process.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to get into this Monterey plant specifically, but Nusha, just staying with you for one last question here.
Sure.
What are some of the alternatives to desalination to provide fresh drinking water?
So if you want to stack them on the priority list, I would say we have to start from minimizing the amount of water we take out of the environment, which means the using less water, conservation efficiency. Then it goes back to trying to capture stormwater and rainwater and use it, treat it and use it for as an alternative. Then goes back to reuse and recycling. And that can happen in various scales. For example, at a household level, people can reuse and recycle their shower water, sink water, and use it for their outdoor water use. This process is called gray water reuse. And this can actually get expanded to neighborhood level reuse or city level reuse, which again takes the wastewater and treats it to different qualities depending on what purpose we want to use water for and sort of apply it to that. And I would say the last sort of solution in that stack is actually desalination, partly because of the amount of energy it uses. And also remember the once through water system that we have, which takes water out of the environment, treats it, brings it to our home, we use it once and takes it away. It sort of brings one quality of water for every purpose of use that we have. So it's not very efficient. So when you're talking about desalination or sort of treated waste, especially desalination, when you put that water back to the water distribution system, that water, which has used a lot of energy and has a lot of carbon footprint and potentially can have some, environmental impact, it gets used to flush toilets or used outdoors. So it's kind of like an inefficient process. So I would say there are so many other alternatives that needs to be implemented before we get to this high energy use and potentially high environmental impact solution that's on the table.
Well, Nusha Ajami, I appreciate this context and overview, and particularly putting desalination in that sort of priority list as really a sort of a last resort here. Melody Krislock from Public Water Now, let me turn to you to talk specifically about this Monterey desalination plant that was just approved. So it's set to produce about 4.8 million gallons of water per day, serving around 100,000 people on the Monterey Peninsula. Can you give us some background on the project, how it came to be, what the history of decision making has been around this up to this point?
Well, first of all, I should point out that it was only conditional approval. It has 20 very tough conditions to meet, and it will take CalAmp years if they can ever meet those.
CalAmp is the entity behind the
California American Water is the culprit behind trying to force a $426 million desal plant on the Monterey Peninsula, and we don't need it. The thing here is that we have, our public agencies, over the past 6 years, have solved our water supply shortage with Pure Water Monterey. That's the Advanced Potable Recycled Water Project. It's now supplying a third of our water. We use about 10,000 acre feet a year for the whole peninsula. It's producing 3,500 acre feet already. And the goal here is to expand it. And that was what the Coastal Commission had said was the feasible alternative. For since 2019, Coastal Commission considered Pure Water Monterey expansion the feasible alternative to CalAmp's desal. All of a sudden, with Governor Newsom's pressure and CalAmp's political connections in Sacramento, they reversed their stance on this. And, you know, the only protection we have now is the 20 conditions to try to get the expansion up and running before CalAmp can, you know, because it will prove that we don't need this desal water. I mean,
these 20 conditions that you're mentioning, it's the California Coastal Commission that's going to be monitoring and determining if the facility meets them.
Yes, yes. They put these 20 conditions on there. This thing was very premature. They don't even have CPUC permission yet to do this. So they were rushing it. They were really rushing this. Even the Coastal Commission said, why are they rushing this? Well, so they're rushing
I appreciate you mentioning the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission. So I'm curious then, it seems like there's a number of steps that have to go forward. I mean, you mentioned these conditions. Are there other agency approvals that have to be given before this can actually become operational?
Yes, there are a number of them. So it's got a long road to go before it would ever be approved, really approved and built. So the problem here is we've got... CalAmp is an investor-owned, you know, private company, and they want this profit center of this $400 million plus desal plant. And they have been trying for 3 years to block the expansion with their political power here on the peninsula. And it's before the CPUC tomorrow. It's in consent. We hope it will be approved and construction can start on the expansion, which would give us another 2,250 acre feet. We only need, our local public water agencies have done an incredible job of really estimating our demand for the next 30 years. We need 1,000 acre feet of water by 2050. But CalAmp wants to give us 5,000 to 6,000 acre feet of outrageously expensive desal water. This water costs $7,000 or more an acre foot. Compare that to Doheny at less than $2,000. There's something very, very wrong with this project from the beginning, and I don't know if we really have time to get into it. But to give you just an overview here, you've got two water districts side by side. CalAmp controls one on the Monterey Peninsula, and Marina Coast Water controls the other one next door, Marina Coast Water District. So what CalAmp wants to do is they want to put their slant wells into Marina Coast groundwater basin, not the ocean. It's very clear that this draws water from their groundwater basin. And then they want to export it to the Monterey Peninsula next door. Marina would get none of this water, but it would take all the risk of further seawater intrusion to its groundwater. And its pristine beaches would suffer all the environmental damage of seven slant wells. Mm-hmm. It's the poster child for environmental injustice here.
But I just wanted to follow up on one comment you made, because you referenced the Doheny desal plant and that this is going to be much more expensive. That one only is about the same size and cost. It's less than $2,000 an acre foot. It's expected to raise bills by only $7 per month. This one, as you mentioned, is projected to raise bills up to $7,000 per month. So can you explain why is...
No, that's the cost of the water per acre foot, $7,000.
$7,000 per month, so for cost of acre foot. So then why is this one so much more expensive What's the difference here between those plants then, for in terms of impact?
A part of it is an incompetent company, CalAmp, who is just keeps charging more and more. When they did the first test slant well, they said it would cost $4 to $6 million, but in the end, it cost $20 million. I mean, so who knows how much a desal plant would cost with CalAmp doing it? But it's expected to raise water bills, according to the CPUC's data. It would raise our typical water bill here is probably about $150 right now for 5,500 gallons. It would raise it about $80 to $100 a month compared to Doheny, which was going to raise it $7 a month. It's completely, that's why the peninsula is outraged over this and refuses to accept it. No one could afford this water, literally. Well,
and Melody, what's the government agency that should be the sort of the watchdog here? I mean, if this is such a big discrepancy in bill impact, it seems like there ought to be an agency that's really scrutinizing this and delving into the explanation for why the numbers are so disparate.
There should be, shouldn't there? Well, the Coastal Commission ignored that fact. I mean, they kept saying, cost is not our issue. Go take it up with the California Public Utilities Commission. Well, okay. But the California Public Utilities Commission has not been really very vigorous in regulating CalAmp. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
I also know the Monterey Peninsula does have a pretty, you know, unique situation potentially in California. It doesn't receive imported water, relies instead on overpumped groundwater, the Carmel River, which is overtaxed, highly treated wastewater. This is all according to CalMatters reporting on this. So can you describe a little bit, Melody, and then Anusha, I'd love to hear your perspective on this as well, what the situation is in Monterey that might make it different from other parts of the state that can rely on imported water?
Well, it is very different. We have two natural water resources, the Carmel River and the 50,000 acre foot seaside groundwater basin. CalAmp, over the last decades, has overdrafted both of them for profit, and they have never provided one drop of new water. But our public agencies got together and said, wait a minute, they're never going to solve this, except with an outrageously expensive desal plant. They solved it with the Potable Recycled Water Project, Pure Water Monterey. So now we're in a position, we would be in a much better position than most of California, because if the expansion, when the expansion is built in about 2 years, two-thirds of our water will at that point be coming from potable recycled water, which is stored in the groundwater basin. It will build up a massive drought reserve over time, and we will have solved our regional water supply issues despite CalAmp's constant interference with our public agencies, which has been our biggest problem. Let me just say one last thing here about what's happened on the peninsula. So CalAmp, you know, continually has raised water costs over since 2013. They've just skyrocketed. And what's happening now is that in 2018, the community got together, Public Water Now sponsored it, and passed Measure J to buy out CalAmp and get rid of them, so that that is now, after the first of the year, our public water agency will make CalAmp an offer, they'll refuse it, and it will go to eminent domain and be a huge fight. But we are really hopeful that we can be rid of this predatory water purveyor, because CalAmp controls this community's water. We have no say, no control over anything CalAmp does, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, regulated monopoly. So I just want to let listeners know, just tuning in, that I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. And we're joined by Melody Krislock, who you just heard, Managing Director of Public Water Now on the Monterey Peninsula, and Dr. Anusha Ajami, Chief Development Officer for Research at the Earth and Environmental Sciences Area at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And we'd love to hear from you if you have a strong opinion on desalination or on this particular proposed plant in Monterey, or are you a supporter of this technology as a way to deal with our increasing droughts? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.com. monterey.org. Nusha, let me ask you the same question about Monterey. It does seem like it's in a uniquely water-constrained situation compared to the rest of the state. How typical is this for California, and what are some of the options for places like Monterey that are essentially islanded from the state's water system?
Yeah, it's not very typical. A lot of the California is dependent on that centralized system that we have, and for good or bad, actually. But I agree with Melanie on the issue related to alternative water supplies. I think, look, as you go down the priority list I laid out, water becomes more, every, you know, drop of water we generate becomes more and more expensive. And desalination is the most expensive water supply that any utility can add to their list of alternative water supplies. So that's why it's very important to kind of consider every other alternative option before getting into desalination. And I think the Pure Water Monterey that Melanie mentioned, which is a recycling process and recycling project, it's it has been quite successful, and the cost of that is a lot less than what is being proposed right now. I think alternatively, what we are seeing right now with these alternative water supply solutions is that you you add more expensive solutions to the portfolio, you end up actually having a lot of cost-related issues related to like bills and how the affordability of the water and who can pay and who cannot. And another problem here is if you are over-generating water by various ways, even if it's a recycling solution, somebody has to pay for that capacity you're building. So, if the entire capacity is not utilized, the individuals that are dependent on that centralized system would all have to bear the cost of the infrastructure that's built. So oversizing is often a preferred approach by utilities because they anticipate increased demand. But it's not necessarily a smart choice, partly because if the demand doesn't rise, you end up with a lot of overcapacity and the challenge of making sure the water is affordable. So Monterey actually had been, that the central coast of California had been dealing with the challenge of water security for a while. This desalination plant is not the first of its kind that have been proposed. Calum has tried over the years to propose different kind of desalination plant, different sizes, in order to create additional water security. But I think to Melanie's point, the Pure Water Monterey has sort of was one of the alternatives that have been implemented and has definitely been a useful project, and it created a lot more water security in that region. So,
Well, let me just turn to Melody Krislock, because I know, Melody, you've got to leave here in just a minute. So I just wanted to give you a kind of a final word from your perspective. What is coming up next year? What is your prediction for what's going to happen with the facility? And for people who want to get involved, what do you suggest?
Well, the problem here is CalM's big lie, and that is that the Pure Water Monterey expansion is not enough water. But even the Coastal Commission's report said it's enough water for at least 20 years. And exactly what Nusha said, you don't oversize water projects because then the cost becomes extraordinary. And we already have, Peninsula already has the most expensive water in California, except for Dillon Beach, connections of 500, and Catalina Island, which is two desal plants. Other than that, for a system of our size or bigger, we've got the most expensive water in the state already. So if you're talking about adding $80 to $100 a month to a bill that's already $150, that's just not doable. And we're hoping that the Public Utilities Commission will see the truth of this and understand that we don't need this project now, and probably not for 20 or 30 years if CalM is even still here. Mm-hmm. Because ideally you want a desal plant like Doheny is publicly owned. it's not a for-profit situation. Because when you get into these for-profit water purveyors, all bets are off. I mean, they will do anything to make, you know, they're only beholden to their investors and their bottom line, not to the communities they serve. And this is a huge problem. And the CPUC has a very bad track record of regulating these companies at all. They usually get away with whatever they want to get away with. Mm-hmm. And right now we're going to see, because no one can force Cal-Am to sign a water purchase agreement to buy the water from Pure Water Monitor Expansion, except for the CPUC. Mm-hmm. And if Cal-Am refuses to sign it, what do we do? What does the community do? They are literally holding our water supply hostage for mm-hmm. profit. This is a terrible situation. I don't think Governor Newsom really understood what the situation here was before he decided to put pressure on the Coastal Commission to conditionally approve this. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation we're here. I actually can stay another 15 minutes, Ethan.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll keep you on then. But I just want to thank you for being able to join us here, and glad you can stay tuned. So for those who are just listening, we're talking about desalination in California and the recent conditional approval of a desalination plant on Monterey County's coast. This is Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this short break. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are talking about desalination in California. Is this a viable strategy to increase fresh drinking water supplies during times of worsening drought that climate change is only projected to make more severe for our state? And we're very pleased to be joined for another 10 or 15 minutes or so by Melody Krislock, who's the managing director of Public Water Now. She's lived on the Monterey Peninsula since 1971. And Dr. Nusha Ajami, chief development officer for research at the Earth and Environmental Sciences area at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, previously a gubernatorial appointee to the Bay Area Regional Water Quality Board for two terms, and now a current mayoral appointee to the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. But we also want to hear from you. Do you think desalination is a viable strategy for a drought-starved California? Is this something that the state should be pursuing more of, or are you opposed to it? We'd love to hear your perspective. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org, or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Nusha Ajami, let me turn to you with an issue that Melody raised, which is this idea that Cal-Am, the company behind this proposed desal plant in Monterey, is investor-owned as opposed to a municipally-owned utility like the one that you serve on with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, or that you regulate through the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Can you describe what the differences are, and does this really make a difference in terms of the outcome for costs and process when you have a privately owned utility that's regulated by the state versus a municipally owned one?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the difference is exactly the difference between the word investor owned versus publicly owned. If it means a publicly owned utility, you are not making any profits off generating, delivering, and selling water to the public. It's a nonprofit process. So you invest in solutions, you generate water, you bring it to people, and you recover the cost of service you are providing to the individuals that depend on that water system. The investor in utilities can actually make money. They're for-profit, so they can make profit off their operational process. And there is a cap on how much money they can make. They're similar to, for example, PG&E and other energy utilities, which are investor-owned. And they have a cap on how much money they can make, but they still are for profit, and they have investors that expect return on their investments, and therefore every decision that they make has to be financially viable and potentially bring additional profit to the company. So mm-hmm. that's the difference between the two.
Well, I appreciate you walking us through that. And let's turn to the phone lines now. We have Mike dialing in. Mike, welcome to Your Call.
Hello. Thank you very much. Yeah, my question is about the brine, the leftover materials after the water is filtered. I understand that the brine disposal was a huge point of contention and environmental concern when they built the Carlsbad plant. And I want to know, what is the progress? What are the best ways to deal with the brine? Or are there any good ways to deal with the brine? Are we just fooling ourselves? This is just another form of toxic pollution. I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you so much, Mike, for that question. I want to hear Melody on this, but Nusha, let me start with you just in terms of what the best practices are and the environmental impacts of brine. I think it's a great question from Mike.
Yeah, so basically the brine is delivered to deep in the ocean, many miles away from the shorelines, and then diffused in that process, in that location, by using different kind of technologies to make sure it mixes and spreads around and doesn't create a concentrated area with high salinity. So having said that, depending on, you know, obviously there's no, depending on where and which location you're in, the currents and how which part of the ocean you're looking at, the currents are different, the water movement is different, so the mixing can be different. There are some technologies on dispersing brine, but it can certainly have an impact in the location that's dispersed, and depending on the time of the day, depending on the conditions of the ocean. There are also for smaller plants that are inland, which they use, they treat brackish water. There are, you know, evaporative ponds are used to let the water evaporate, and then the rest of the brine is left and dealt with eventually in various ways. So these are the two ways that are happening, but they're technologically, we are not necessarily that much more advanced than we were like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, so this is an area of significant concern. And Melody Krislock, what about the brine specific to this proposed project in Marina? What are you concerned about? What are, you know, some of the conditions that you mentioned earlier in the show apply to this? What's the latest on the brine impacts?
The wastewater public agency here would have to agree to have let CalAmm use their outfall, and they have not done that. So that's a big condition. They would mix the brine with the municipal waste, which dilutes it, and it's one of the reasons Doheny did the same thing. It's a good thing to mix it, because then it doesn't create the dead zones, theoretically anyway, in the ocean that straight brine would. But I wanted to say something Nusha said about the profit that these companies are entitled to. It's 10%. They're entitled to a 10% profit on their assets. So you can see that a $400 million desal plant gets to be a pretty good investment for CalAmm. And over, I think, 30 years of its life, it would generate probably $1.5 billion in profit. It's a lot of money. And it's not, you really have to, it's a joke that the CPUC would really regulate this. They've had a terrible time regulating these water utilities. And it just doesn't seem to happen. I mean, they can rein them in a little bit, but not a lot. So this desal for all policy that Newsom is pushing it's crazy from our perspective. It's everyone in California should be thinking about the potable recycled water. In a few years, it'll be direct potable reuse. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you don't have a groundwater basin, you can't really use potable recycled water, because you have nowhere to store it. But we do. We have like 25,000 acre feet of storage in the Seaside Basin. So it's our solution. It's a great solution. And we wish that Newsom would have listened to our public agencies instead of CalAmm's.
Well, Melody, I know you've got to jump, but I just wanted to follow up one more question on the brine point that the caller Mike raised. You know, given the environmental impacts from brine, but also given the sensitivity of the Monterey Peninsula, I mean, this is a, you know, home to the world class Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's a sensitive ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Were there folks from the environmental community who were sort of on this issue of brine and the impacts to the environment from this particular facility?
Yes, there were. There was plenty of concern. But for some reason, the board of the Marine Sanctuary, I don't think they've actually ruled on this yet. I think that may be another permit. But the State Lands Commission is another one of the permits Calman has to get. There's just a lot of there's a lot that Calman will have to do to ever get this built. And no one here really believes that it will actually be built.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you explaining this issue for our listeners. It's Melody Chrislock, Managing Director of Public Water Now. Thank you so much for joining us on your call.
Thanks so much.
All right, and let's go. Yeah, Nusha, please go ahead.
Just a quick thought here on the Brian as well that they wanted to share. There are some efforts, research efforts, mostly in the research side, people are looking into how potentially they can repurpose the brine, using it in concrete or trying to extract valuable minerals from the brine. Most of these are sort of in the research process, but there are some work going on right now trying about how to put brine into beneficial use. So I would be remiss if not mention that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Anusha, for adding that. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Greg standing by. Greg, welcome to your call.
Hello, thank you. One thing that occurred to me was when you're talking about financing for some of this, and by the way, I support desalination, but if they can find other ways to do it without that, I'd welcome that. But just a mention about your program on Monday where you were talking about Diablo Canyon, I think. The federal government and the state are guaranteeing $1 billion plus to PG&E to do this. I'm not sure why they can't come up with the money for creative solutions and why the government isn't more. I mean, this is a dire situation. If the drought goes on, where is L.A. and the Bay Area going to get their water? How are they going to produce enough water and or get enough water? And it seems to me that this may be an option for those two large locations. And I just don't know enough about desalination. But it seems to me that the state doesn't have the sense of urgency to be dumping an incredible amount of money into this to try and figure out how this is going to work and how to get out of this problem.
Yeah. Thank you, Greg, for raising this this concern around potential lack of urgency. Nusha, what's your response to Greg's point here?
Yeah, I think, look, desalination is definitely one option in the bucket of options we have. And I think one thing to remember is because of the centralized system we have right now, the fact that we are bringing water from far distances and using it for various purposes, we are not necessarily thinking about water very efficiently. So I think the project like recycling projects that Melanie mentioned and that's implemented in Central Coast, they sort of bring this sort of circular economy to water. And that is where we want to go. We want to make sure we use and reuse water as many times as we can, therefore to reduce our dependence on the environment and reduce our footprint as we use water in different ways. So I would say definitely investing in recycling and reuse in different scales would be the better sort of path for the future. So again, as I said earlier, we are using exact the same technologies we are using for desalination, for recycling and reuse. So the water that comes out of that process is pure and pristine and can be used for various purposes. So and yes, we have to invest in those projects in various scale. And actually, various part of California is either considering recycling in different scales to enhance their water supplies and minimize their dependence on the nature. And some areas have already been sort of either permitting or starting some of those projects. So you see there is a movement towards those kind of solutions. Desalination sort of perpetuates the model that we have and doesn't necessarily help, because we keep saying there is another source of water we can bring in and people can use it however they want it. And that doesn't really help. And also in California, we are trying to reduce our carbon footprint. So, trying to minimize the amount of energy we need to generate water has to be one of the priorities we are considering. So that's another reason to think about alternative water supplies beyond desal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Nusha, for addressing that comment. And thank you, Greg, for dialing in and also for linking it to our show on Monday and the connection to the nuclear power plant at Diablo Canyon. I appreciate you joining us. This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. And we are discussing desalination in California and specifically the recent conditional approval of a desalination plant in Monterey County in the low-income community of Marina. We appreciate the calls. And if you have a comment or question, you can join us as well at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you have a strong opinion on desalination or live near the proposed plant, we would love to hear from you. And in the meantime, I want to go to the call lines. We have John dialing in. So, John, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. I just want to make two quick points about the Cal-Am proposal in particular. The first had to do with the excess capacity problem that has been noted. The local water district that's responsible for the peninsula's water supply did an estimate of how the excess capacity would increase rates. And so if, in fact, only 20% of the capacity were used, the rates would be four times higher than they would be if 100% of the capacity. So the earlier number that was given today was $7,000. That assumes full capacity. That means it's running out full blast. But if it's only running, say, 20%, it's going to be, you know, $28,000 an acre foot. And the Coastal Commission simply ignored that fact. They paid no attention to it. And there's no question that the capacity won't be needed for at least 20 years, and yet Cal-Am wants to build it in this decade. So they're either going to substitute more expensive desalinated water for less expensive recycled water, or they're going to charge the ratepayers for this idle capacity. My second point is simply that as a regulated utility, not only are they entitled to a fixed 10% profit, but they have no competition. And so the other reason that it costs so much money is that Cal-Am has no incentive to save costs. In fact, it has just the opposite incentive. The more money it spends, the higher its rate base and the bigger their absolute returns are. And, I mean, you know, this is a feature of regulated utilities. And Cal-Am has already sunk $200 million into this project, which it fully expects to recover whether it builds it or not. Mm-hmm. All right. Just comment. Thanks.
Yeah. No, John, thank you so much. I appreciate your knowledgeable perspective here on this. And I think you raise a really important point around incentives. And Nusha, I wanted to ask you to respond to John's basically larger contextual point here that Cal-Am, being an investor-owned utility, perhaps doesn't have the incentive to focus on lower-cost solutions like recycling. Is there validity to that? Do you see that dynamic playing out in general in California and other jurisdictions that have similar structure, governance structure like what we have here with water utilities?
I'd say actually in general, water utilities are sort of, their business model is to build water supplies and bring it to people, right? And that model is not, doesn't lend itself to sort of focusing on conservation, efficiency, the repurposing, different water supplies. So it's kind of now, if you are dealing with an investor-owned utility, that is even a bigger problem, right? Because then ultimately that water needs to be sold, and there is always a recovery capacity that can always recover the cost of service they're providing to the full and make 10% on top of it, as Melanie mentioned. So it is, I think the water sector, as you're sort of walking into this and facing these 21st century problems, need to revisit its business model, regardless if it's a publicly owned or a privately owned utility. And we have to kind of make their business model more appropriate for the time you're living in. I think one other comment John made that I think it's very important to highlight is people often forget, but desalination is not a turn off, turn on kind of a solution. It's not like you can turn it off during wet years and then turn it back on during dry years and use it at that time. Everybody talks about how it's a drought-proof solution. The problem with solutions like desal is that you have to operate and maintain this system continuously, and that's costly. Which means that even if it's a wet year, even if you have enough water in the system, even if you have cheaper water options on the deck, you basically may end up using the desalinated water because that water needs to be used and generated and sold. So I think that is one problem of over building or having idle capacity. It's just that somehow that cost needs to be recovered. So,
well, Anusha, it seems to me what you're raising is really a governance issue. I know this affects the electricity side of the equation because we have the same issues there where electric utilities are incentivized to build stuff instead of conserving. And the state has come up with a way to compensate electric utilities for conservation, to give them a profit motive to encourage conservation. It doesn't always work perfectly, but at least it's there. Do we not have the same thing on the water side? I mean, it seems like, you know, you don't necessarily have to have this problem with a privately owned, investor-owned utility if the governance structure is set up better to incentivize them to look for lower cost alternatives like conservation, right?
Absolutely. I think, look, the droughts have been playing that role. As every drought that has come around, water utilities have been trying to promote conservation and efficiency to ride that drought period or ride that wave. Governance-wise, it's not in place. I think electric utilities are about 20, 30 years ahead of water utilities. They have been their business model have been revisited during the past 30 years for various reasons. And especially during the energy crisis in the late 90s, we have not had that in the water utilities. The whole decoupling the rates was a very important process that helped the electric utilities to not only focus on the conservation and efficiency side, actually, I would say demand management side, which is trying to reduce demand, but also having an eye on capacity building. So we have not had that in the water sector. There has been a bill. There was a bill that would pass the legislature last year that is going to require investor-owned utilities to decouple their water rates. And that might potentially help the process a little bit, nudging this transition to happen. But still, publicly owned utilities do not have that in place. Some have picked up the demand, decoupling their rates, voluntarily, but not many of them are doing this right now.
All right. Well, we have a couple more callers on the line here. Appreciate all this listener interest. Let's go to Jack calling in from Santa Cruz. Jack, you're on your call. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. And I heard one thing so far on this show that I think is the most important, and that's that desalination is the most energy intensive way of producing potable water. And I think we can't lose sight of the fact that we're in a climate crisis. We're trying to reduce our carbon footprint. So we're talking about things like electrifying cars, doing a lot of things that place additional demand on the electricity grid. So proposing to introduce a water production means that has high energy demand just works against climate action. It just seems so obvious to me. I've felt a need to call in and underscore the obvious that we should not be choosing the most energy intensive way of producing water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jack, thank you so much for highlighting that point. I think it does get lost a lot in this debate. And Anusha, what is your response on this? I mean, how does the energy demand kind of fit into the state's overall goals, as Jack pointed out here, to reduce energy consumption and to use the energy that we do produce, ideally from renewable sources, for other things like transportation and electrifying buildings, getting off of natural gas in buildings, et cetera? Where does this fit into that state priority?
Look, I think water and energy are quite interlinked. However, we govern them in silo, and we don't really we all often you lose sight of one when we are regulating the other. And it is important. I think this is highlighting the fact that it is important for us to think a little bit more in the system level, think about the interlinks between water and energy, realizing how a lot of the decisions we are making in the two fields can impact one another. If we really want to build a sustainable future, the reality is we need to be more, I think, both for water and energy, demand side management is going to be key if we want to have a resilient urban areas or resilient communities. So I would say for both, it's all about, it has to start from demand management.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that. And we have time for just one more quick question. So Pat, calling into your call. Pat, very briefly, what's your question for Nusha? Do we have Pat on the line? All right, not hearing Pat. We did get one more off-air question, which I wanted to raise to you, which is, what are the prospects for multiple desalination plants on the coast of California that are controlled by the people and not corporations? Is there the potential for more municipally owned utility approaches to this issue, Nusha? This is the last question because we're out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah, sure. So look, the future is going to be all about modular solutions. We are all going to consider small sort of technological solution that can potentially augment the shortfalls that we have in our water supplies and resources. I would say again, we have to start from, we went through the list of trying to do demand management, recycling, reuse, capturing stormwater. And then ultimately, if there is still shortfalls, going to small desalination plants as a solution. But definitely trying to right-size these solutions and make sure we are not overbuilding, oversizing them is going to be key. Another point I will make here is, remember, nobody wants to have a not very beautiful infrastructure on their coast, because we all are proud of the coast that we have in California. So ultimately, a lot of these decisions comes down to making sure we don't end up having a lot of impact on our coastal regions, and we make sure we can protect our environment as much as we can.
Thank you, Nusha, for that. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us. Nusha Jami, Chief Development Officer for Research at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to B. Saul for producing today's show and to Kevin Vance for engineering it. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us at yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.